The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we get to sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and related music industry experts. If you love playing guitar, stick around. You're in the right place. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber from Everyone Loves Guitar, and I am here with the one and only John Butcher from the John Butcher Axis.
Hey.
Really happy to have John on the show. John's one of the guests that is kind of weird for me in the sense that because I remember buying his records in the store, and he's not that much older than me, but it's always a weird thing. Like, you know, you can't connect the dots, you know, moving forward, I guess.
Yeah, I know, Craig. That was in the horse and buggy days. You know, we were making records, you know, on the prairie. So, you know, I understand what you're saying.
Yeah, it was a minute ago. Yeah. As founder of the John Butcher Axis, Grammy nominee John Butcher has 19 national and international releases, and his MTV and VH1 music videos were the underpinnings of a supercharged music career that continues today. In 2017, John released Two Roads East, delivering 10 new and original songs recorded with special guest stars. This on the heel of John's critically acclaimed CDs, Axis 3, and the Jimi Hendrix-fueled Experience. John's acoustic work on acoustic guitar, dobro, and banjo has found its way into feature film, cable TV, into his live concert schedule, and it's also a major component into understanding his music. He's also had appearances with Experience Hendrix Tour and at Fenway Park for the Boston Red Sox. As a Yankee fan, I cannot condone that, but, you know, to each his own. I grew up 20 blocks from Yankee Stadium. And John's output is more diverse than ever. His media company, Electric Factory X, continues to provide film score, soundtrack, and music licensing for television and film, including Shameless on the Showtime Network, The Simpsons on Fox, 6 Feet Under on HBO, The Sopranos on HBO, Deadwood, United States of Tara on Showtime, Ugly Betty, ABC, My Name is Earl, and The Life and Times of Buffalo Bill on the A&E Network. John, man, I really appreciate your time. It's such a pleasure to have you here, man.
Thanks very much for having me. It's good to talk to you.
You originally went to college in Boston, as I understand it, to study broadcast journalism. Was that accurate, or is that a...
No. My parents, they could kind of see the handwriting on the wall that I was going to be a musician and that I was, you know, completely focused on the guitar and music. And so they said, well, look, you got to have something, you know, how parents think you've got to do something in your back pocket,
yeah.
Just in case things don't work out, right? So so I chose a broadcast journalism school called Graham Junior College, which is in Kenmore Square in Boston, or at least it was. And here's a little trivia for you. Unbeknownst to me, I was attending that college at the same time as Johnny A. So he and I were
That's funny.
I know. For exactly the same reasons. He was there because his parents thought it was a good idea to have something in his back pocket. So we became friends back then. And, you know, I've always been interested in television, but I think I just went to that school to kind of appease my folks.
Mm. Interesting. Do you know Johnny A? I interviewed him. His interview came out yesterday, funny enough. It's kind of – world can't get any smaller here.
Did he mention did he happen to mention Graham Junior College? I'm just curious.
I do not think he mentioned that. No, we talked about high school stuff, but I don't think we talked about college with Johnny.
Yeah, he and I went to the same school, so that's pretty funny.
That is funny, man. So then 1982, Jay Giles, they're at the height of their game with the Freeze Frame album, and Peter Wolfe asks you to go and open for them. I was curious how that connection came about and what kind of opportunities did being the opening act on this massive tour lead, you know, open, what kind of doors did it open for you?
We got contacted from the Jay Giles band by a mutual friend we had at WBCN Radio. And as you might imagine, dude, we went from playing clubs and being successful and packing small rooms to three nights at the Boston Garden to kick off the tour. So it was absolutely terrifying and also, as you might imagine, thrilling at the same time.
Did you know, usually when that happens, it's you don't really have time to sit and process it. What was like when you're standing on stage at the Boston Garden? Did you have even, if you could remember or if it happened, what's like going through your mind?
Absolute terror. I mean, I've literally tried. I remember being in the dressing room backstage and Wolf came by the dressing room and gave me some sage advice, which I can't remember at all. and I just sort of was as wide-eyed and innocent as possible. And My memory really is is after those three nights, because while it was happening, it was completely sensory overload.
What was the, like, when that tour ended, did you have an opportunity to decompress? Or I know that period of history for you was incredibly busy.
No, there wasn't any time to process. When we finished that, we didn't have a record deal when we started that tour. There was no, we couldn't get arrested by record companies. And after that tour, after those 70 cities or 72, as you know, all of a sudden we were a commodity. You know, just literally, as soon as the tour was over, our manager at the time got assigned to Polydor.
Wow, which was a very big label at that time.
Yeah, at the time it was. In fact, we signed our deal at the same time as John Bon Jovi. We were literally in the office at the same time. So that Freeze Frame tour was the kickoff of the whole thing, really.
Very cool, man. It's funny. I remember, like, as a kid, I could see the label, the Polydor label on the record spinning around. That's how popular it was. There's so many Polydor records I had. You had a real popular video on MTV for Life Takes a Life from your first album, The John Butcher Axis. And I read somewhere online, and I was wondering if it was true, that you were one of the first black artists to have a video on Steady Rotation.
Yeah, right. Me and Michael Jackson.
Wow.
At the time, I mean, I can't account for it, because a lot has to do with the fact that, at least as I recall it, MTV had an unofficial color barrier that I really wasn't aware of until we, you know, until we butted up against it. And having them add our video, I didn't know it was a big deal. At the time it happened, there was no sort of, you know, eureka moment. Right. It was just like, oh, cool, MTV added our video. It was only until years later that we found out that they weren't playing any black rock guitar players at all. I mean, you'd see something by Hendrix occasionally, but nobody knew, you know?
Man, what's weird about that is, you know, back then, you know, in the 70s and the 80s, we were living in an age where radio was really, like, rock radio was not like it is today. It wasn't, stations weren't segregated or niched out that much. You know, you'd hear
exactly
Earth, Wind and Fire on WPLJ in New York City, or WNED, you know, all the big rock stations. You'd hear Earth, Wind and Fire followed by Jay Giles, followed by Lynyrd Skynyrd, followed by John Butcher Axis.
Exactly right. And the reason why that was is because at the time, radio was a frontier. And so, you know, the kind of music you heard on any given station was just music.
Yes.
It was all new music, and there was no fragmentation.
Mm.
Now, of course, as you know, it's completely splintered.
Yeah.
And there is a niche for every kind of music, and very rarely do you hear any station cross-pollinating at all.
Yeah. Which is why I don't like my kids. They all make fun of me. They're like, "Hey, Dad, you know, you should get Apple Music. It's $10 a month." And I said, "You know, I don't want to stream, because I have, like, you know, 40 or 50,000 songs in my iTunes, which I access from the cloud. And I could just say, play everything from this genre, or play everything that's five star." Mm-hmm. And then I get five star songs I like. It's not like, you know, only this or only that. And I kind of prefer that, you know.
Well, I miss terrestrial radio for a lot of reasons. As a touring musician and a professional guitarist, I appreciated being able to go to a radio station in a given city and make friends with the program director and get my record added, yeah. and have a sort of tactile relationship with radio and the people that play your stuff,
yeah,
and connecting to fans in that way, and that's all gone.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so let's continue down that same time frame. So obviously, you guys, after you signed the deal, kept gaining in popularity, and then you started opening up for even bigger arena acts like Rush, Def Leppard, Scorpions, and INXS. What was that like? In totality, you have to go through each one.
These were packages. These tours that we did in those years were packaged. It would be Def Leppard and Axis and Crocus.
I haven't heard that in ages. Wow. Wow, that's...
For 40 or 50 cities. And then there'd be Rush and Axis and Rick Derringer. And these package tours were cool because it was a wide spectrum of music. It was a little chaotic, though, as time went on in terms of, getting tired and worn out from it.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. I interviewed a guitar player a while back, and he was just about to embark on a tour, and then we had a chance to speak in the middle of his tour, and I said to him, "Hey, where are you today?" And he was like, I said, "You don't even know." And he said, "No." And he said, "I swore that would never happen to me, and I just have no, it's like a blur. I'm going from one place to the next. I have no clue where I am."
It's impossible to keep it straight if you're doing, imagine doing 60 cities, which can translate to say 75 or 80 days.
Yeah.
And after day 30, a lot of the arenas begin to look alike, a lot of venues you're playing, and you don't see much of the town, You pull in after an overnight drive, and you check into the hotel. You go from there to the venue for sound check. You play the show. After the show, it's dark. You go either to your bunk to the next city, or to the hotel, and then to the next city.
Hmm.
Not really a bandwidth for sightseeing. So it's easy to forget where you are.
Yeah, I totally get it. Talk about. You have a company, Electric Factory X, that's involved with licensing and sync stuff. What prompted you to set this up, and exactly what does the company do?
I saw the writing on the wall somewhere around, 2008 or 9, that the music business was going through a serious adjustment in terms of both the way music is consumed, the way fans buy it, the entire business was structured, and record companies themselves were on their way out. As streaming became viable, and so like a lot of guys, I kind of had to reappraise my career and figure out how I was going to be able to stay a professional musician while not selling records to make a living. Each year that went by from like 2007 to 2008, you could see a reduction in record sales and record stores, outlets, Tower Records was starting to close those, yeah. That chain. And so you start to see this and you go, okay, what am I going to do? And I've always had I've always had a foot in media music, since I got hired to do, the Homer and Bart Simpson thing for Fox Television back then. And I figured that I would continue that because I enjoyed it. It allowed me an outlet to be creative. And it was something that I had a network, had built a kind of a network. So I began to throw myself more seriously into licensing music and creating music for television. That led to feature film and indie film and every other kind of thing like that, video games. And so Electric Factory was that conduit for me to work. Now, what happened in recent years, it grew into a company that now we're an artist management company, and also a company that does
corporate events in addition to licensing music for television. So it started out as a vehicle for me to work, and it grew to a business that has expanded to sign new artists.
So when you say artist management, can you explain exactly what that means? Because I think, you know, that's a very, for the average person listening, it's like they've heard it, but they don't know specifically what it means.
EFX is particularly interested in finding and cultivating young talent, the next generation of guitar players or songwriters or, you know, whatever it may be. Because we feel, my partner and I, Leighton Wolf and I, feel that to look towards the future, it has to be about young people connecting to music, as I did, in a visceral way, and finding ways in the world to make that a living wage, how to make a living doing music as a professional. So we engage with young artists who we feel have promise and talent and have shown an aptitude to do certain things, and we help them. We help manage their abilities and try and connect them to money-making opportunities. And that's kind of what that's kind of how I would describe artist management.
So when you find this young talent, what is, if any, from their perspective, or from your perspective in looking at them, is there any difference between the new musician or the younger musician today and then from, you know, guys like you when you were their age?
Let me share something with you. I'm producing a young band right now in the studio called Glimpses. Young guys, you know, 16, 17, 18 years old, who have, instead of being drawn to hip hop or, you know, the prominent pop music form of the day, they're drawn to rock guitar as it was expressed in the early and mid 70s. These are young guys who have discovered this music and are making it their own and expressing it in their own way. And the guitar player's name is Ryan Bowen. Now, I asked Ryan one day, I said, how did you come to like this? What drew you to this style of music and wanting to be a guitar player instead of, say, a rapper? And he couldn't explain it any better than I could at that age. Hmm. It just connected with him. And that gave me hope, Craig. It gave me hope that the world isn't just a hip-hop world, that there are young people still interested in sort of mastering an instrument and learning how to express art on it and wanting to do that for their life. So I met these young guys. I'm producing them right now. And Ryan Bowen is a shining example of young people who are carrying that tradition forward.
Man, that's really good to hear, because it seems like the trend is more towards less played music and more made music.
Dude, I thought that too, believe me.
Yeah.
And then I met, there's another young guy I'm producing right now. His name is Quentin Calawart. He has gravitated towards fingerstyle acoustic guitar, and he's brilliant.
Great.
And I'm working on his first record right now, and these young guys, both Quentin and Ryan, have now affirmed, for me at least, that the world hasn't changed altogether.
Yeah.
That there is still an interest in conventionally expressed music, you know, on instruments.
Right.
And so that's I'm very encouraged, and I think the whole thing is very promising for the future. I'm very encouraged by it.
That's awesome to hear. Do you have kids, and what kind of music do they listen to?
No, I don't. I don't. Okay. My wife and I don't have children.
Okay, because I have three, and my older one listens to kind of like, they all have their foot in the new music, but my older one, at least, like, I can, like, if John Butcher was coming to town, I'd be like, Nick, let's go see John. He likes that kind of music.
You could talk him into that.
No, I don't have to. He actually likes it. You know, we go to concerts together all the time, you know. So
is he a player? Is he a guitar player?
No, he's not. He's not.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
He's not, but he has that, you know. I've probably taken him to all kinds of concerts, from like, you know, Hot Tuna to Government Mule, Allman Brothers, just, you know, regular rock that that you and I grew up listening to, you know.
There are two things that I discovered this year, or 2017, that I discovered in 2017 that have given me huge hope. Here are the two things. First of all, I have discovered that there is an interest in real music, and by real music I only mean conventionally expressed music, mm-hmm. played on instruments as opposed to just computers.
Yeah.
And that fire burns in more kids than you might think. And the second thing I learned is that these young people, I'm not sure they're millennials, have developed a huge social conscience, and that gives me hope for the future.
Yes,
I had thought that maybe, you know, that the world was just going to go down the tubes for a number of reasons. You know, some of them political, and seeing these kids respond to, for instance, the gun debate,
yeah,
and seeing these young people become active and marching and expressing and emoting has filled my heart. I can't even tell you how happy that makes me.
That's good. Yeah, a lot of people have kind of said the same thing, that it's the first optimistic thing that they've come across in a while from that generation.
These young people are engaged, and the young artists that I'm working with right now are engaged, man. They're tuned in, and they're on fire, and that fills me with huge joy.
Awesome. I know you got your hands or your toes in a lot of different ponds. What are you working on now that you're most excited about?
Producing these young people's first records is important to me. There's a mentoring aspect to it too, you know, that mm-hmm. that I find meaningful. I mean, at this point in my career, I feel like I've been really lucky. I mean, really a lucky guy. I've got a chance to see the world and build my studio and my home and my family and do all of these things because of music. And so now, as I look back on all these small accomplishments, I'm really feeling like what I want to do now is look towards the future and pay that forward. So working with talented young people is exciting to me. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm still playing live. You know, I've got a show I'm really looking forward to coming up in a couple of weeks here in Massachusetts, Rockport, Massachusetts, at a venue called the Chalon-Lieu Performance Center. I'm looking forward to that show on April 20th. And I do a handful of, or more than a handful of shows every year. But my real interest is in developing new music and developing new artists.
What, you mentioned your show. What talk about the show, because you were really enthusiastic about it before we
started. Yeah, I've got some of my touring musician friends joining me. The night we're doing is called Spring Guitar Summit, and my buddy Cliff Goodwin from Joe Cocker's band is going to join me. My friend Tomo Fujita, who's a brilliant guitar player who schooled John Mayer, he's going to be joining me as well. Several other musicians from around the globe are coming to join me for this Spring Guitar Summit, and again, that's April 20th at the Chalon-Lieu Performance Center in Rockport, Massachusetts.
That'll be on either your website or your Facebook?
Absolutely, yeah. Okay, it's cool. On both, yep.
Okay, so I know you're like from the Boston area, I think?
Yeah, I went to, not originally, but I ended up coming to Boston to go to college.
Oh, okay, where'd you originally grow up?
Pennsylvania.
Whereabouts?
With a stop in Alaska for a few years.
Wow.
My father, I was born in Pennsylvania, but the family moved to Alaska during my childhood because my dad worked for the government, for the Ballistic Missile Early Warning System, radar sites up in Fairbanks, Alaska. And so I had an opportunity to grow up in a really small community, really small, like maybe 80 people, and in the middle of the wilderness. So all there was for me was guitar. That was the thing that was my connect to the world.
Wow. So you were in Alaska up until you went to college.
High school.
Out of high school. Yeah. And then you moved to Boston.
I moved back to the family went back to Pennsylvania so I could finish high school. I had one more year. And then it was off to Boston.
Wow. Okay. So what was growing up like? What was your childhood like?
Really, idyllic. If what you like is wilderness. I grew up about 90 miles from Fairbanks in central Alaska in a community called Liaho. I went to a one room school with three grades in it. Wow. You know, I think I was one of four in the seventh grade. And it was just, you know, I didn't have a lot to compare it to. So for me, I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize, I mean, I didn't really get my introduction to urban reality and life in America until the family moved from Alaska back to the East Coast. And that was culture shock.
What? Yeah, in what way, I would imagine?
Well, racially, I had been introduced to words I didn't know when I came back to Pennsylvania. And at that time, there was the social upheaval and the remnants of the Vietnam War,
mm-hmm.
and civil rights. So take your pick. There was culture shock every direction I looked in.
Yeah. Wow. Do you think music helped you as an outlet to deal, just to process all that shit?
There's no question that it was the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix and all of that music, which allowed me to find my place in the world. Not just as an outlet, but as a way of seeing myself. I sort of came to, I think it happened to a lot of us, right? We became ourselves to a large degree through the music.
Yeah. I like what you said. Music allowed you to find your place in the world.
Yeah. I mean, that was the window by which I looked through and saw who I was. The music did that for me.
That's pretty cool. Did you have any brothers or sisters?
I have a younger brother, 6 years younger than I am. He's not a musician, he and I are close even to this day.
That's cool.
And he's had quite a laugh watching me take this ride for the past, you know, 25, 30 years.
Yeah. That's really wild that you moved from such a rural place to and then got that kind of culture shock. I didn't.
Oh yeah, man! My first year of moving back to Pennsylvania was horrible. My grades suffered. I was completely depressed. You know, I didn't know which end was up and who I was and all of this language I'd never heard before. You know, there was a lot to get used to.
Yeah, it's weird when you grow up in a big city. I think in many ways it's probably easier and nicer to move to like a place where you grew up in Alaska than the other way around.
Than the other way.
Yeah. I could easily see that because it's tough enough growing up there to deal with all the shit going on.
My wife Lorinda grew up in the city of in Boston.
Mm.
She grew up in, I think the town was called Somerville, and her childhood and mine couldn't be more different in terms of being young and sort of discovering yourself, you know. So it's funny how we, you know, I mean, we met still that the roads converged at some point, but at the beginning, you know, we laugh about it now, but her life growing up in the city was certainly different than mine growing up in Liaho.
You know what? I know exactly what you're talking about because I'm from the Bronx. My wife is from a little village in England.
There you go. You know exactly what I mean.
I know exactly. And it's funny because she tells me, I don't even think she saw a black person until high school.
There wasn't. When I shared with you about language, right?
Yeah.
You can imagine some of the words I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Now, before that time, I hadn't seen myself in those terms at all. I mean, there was nothing I had in my personal experience to compare that to. So it was music and all the kinds of music that I listened to then that gave me a sense that, first of all, I wasn't alone, you know, in dealing with this stuff.
Yeah.
And secondly, that there were like-minded people like me. I wanted to go to Woodstock, man. Of course, I was too young. My mom wouldn't let me go, but I was ready to go to Woodstock and hang out in the mud. I mean, I was a hippie.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
Hey, what outside of, let's talk about musically. You've been at this game a long time. What were some of the biggest challenges you've had to deal with throughout this journey?
Trying to find my place in the music business. When you first make records, when you first get signed to a record deal, you're, even though you know better, you kind of feel like, wow, I've made it. I got there. And then you discover all you've really done is open the door to the beginning of the race.
Mm-hmm.
And so trying to navigate my art and trying to be a songwriter and develop that skill and how to do all those things was difficult at the beginning because the forces at play were different. As we've both talked about, the music business is different now than it was.
Sure.
And the old paradigms have shifted. Case in point, I had worked all of, you know, I'd labored under the illusion that what I wanted to do was become popular and successful enough to make records and sell them and make a living from that. Well, then all of a sudden the music business, that sort of paradigm disappeared. You couldn't make records and make a living because people were beginning to download music for free.
Right.
So that was difficult. You know, that was a challenge. And when the music changed from analog, the music business changed from analog to digital, that was a challenge. I had never before thought that I would have to master computer-based recording. Huge learning curve, huge.
Yeah.
But there was no way around it because things weren't going to go back. They were only going to move forward.
You sound like you're pretty adaptable with change like that. Or is this like the end process of like, you know, years of just figuring it out and acceptance and just developing a plan B? Or were you pretty like, okay, you know, I got to do something right away?
Yes to both.
Yeah, I gotcha.
I was sitting in, check this out, man. I was sitting in my apartment in Cambridge, Mass. This was on the eve of the Jay Giles Experience.
Hmm.
And even then, even way back then, I knew in 82 that the way of making it in the music business was changing because the ways of doing things were changing. Digital recording was just beginning to be a thing. And even I remember telling Chris Martin that you have a choice. Change or die. Evolve or die. And so that was my mantra from the early 80s on. Evolve or die. You have to be willing to reinvent yourself. And I've done that in my career, geez, several times.
So my question was, how did you get like that as far as that's a skill set or a talent? And I'm curious, like, did things in your early youth prepare you for sort of looking at things like, okay, we need to change? Or was it just like a survival skill that you had developed along the way? Because I think at a young age to have that like you did, I think that's pretty impressive.
I'd never thought this is an excellent question, and I'd never thought about it until this very moment. And I realize now I have to thank my mom for that.
she was the one who she wasn't a quitter. She's passed on now, but she was a person I learned to never quit from. I've seen her work various jobs, and survive the divorce, and raise kids by herself, and I think that's where that came from. I didn't even know that until this moment. I watched her never quit, never give up, and that became my mantra without me even realizing it.
That's great, man. Thank you for sharing it. Just so you know, when someone tells me, I never thought of that, that's like music to my ears, because my goal is not to not regurgitate anything else with you or anybody else I chat with, whether we're talking on an interview or if we were you and I were talking in a bar. My goal is to not, you know, waste time talking about something that's like, you know, the fish on the wall deal.
I didn't realize until you asked me that my willingness to switch to another gear or make a left turn or a right turn or whatever it is, use any, you know, way of expressing it you like. I picked that up directly from my mom and watching her do the same thing. And I must have admired that quality because that's where that came from.
Yeah, that's because it is a skill set. It's something that is not, like, I don't think, just naturally inherent.
I had mentioned to you earlier in our chat that trying to get a record deal, prior to the Giles tour was an exercise in futility. We got turned down by everybody. And even in those times when some of my musician friends would give up or get a straight job or whatever they were doing, I was just like, nah, I just got to write something better. I just got to do this better. I just got to figure it out. And so that was where I took my entire career.
That's awesome. That's good, man. That's a good survival set.
I think so.
Let me ask you this. If you had to, John of today, go back and give, you know, young John Butcher advice from 20 or 30 years ago, what advice would you have liked to give yourself?
Holy cow. How much time do we have?
As much as you want, bro.
I would, so many things I would tell young John Butcher now. To start with, I mean, it sounds funny, but I would have told myself to stick to my original guns in terms of music style and not allow myself to be seduced by the times. Mm. I don't want to point to a particular record or song, but I think that in the interest of wanting to be successful, I made a couple of choices musically that I wished I hadn't. I wished I'd had the courage to stay within whatever genre I was doing. Let's just say it that way.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, you know, that was way back then in the early days when I was desperate to have a hit record. Now I realize that you know, I would have told myself, dude, don't worry about trying to find a hit record. Let it find you.
Right.
And keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, that is that's one of those things. It's really hard to know that when you're younger, isn't it?
Well, it's impossible to know. Some things you only come by. I know you'll appreciate this. There's some knowledge that you can only come by the hard way.
Tuition.
You cannot come by certain knowledge the easy way.
Yeah.
I wish that weren't true, but it is true.
Hmm.
And so my best, you know, my most valuable lessons were the lessons I learned from failure.
Yeah, I think that's everybody. I mean, I agree with you.
Yeah, but not everybody sees that, dude. Not everybody sees failure in that way. Oftentimes, we process failure as a completely negative experience from which we got nothing. Lots of people think of failure in that way. And I haven't allowed myself to do that. I've got to find I always felt like I had to find the lesson in the failure.
Yeah, well, you don't feel like a victim when you do that.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, you know, even if, like, I know me, like, when something bad happens, I always, okay, what was my responsibility in this? Because then, like I said, I don't feel like a victim. I feel like, okay, I screwed up, and I can forgive myself for that.
I think the worst thing that ever happened to me, I mean, if I'm being honest,
yeah,
is my divorce. I've been divorced once, married once and divorced. And that was the worst thing that's ever happened to me in my life. It's the thing that had the deepest impact and the most devastating result. And even from that, even there, I learned how to be a better man and how to be a better human from that horrible experience. And I carried that forward to my next and hopefully last marriage to my present wife. I carried to her my experience from that and trying to be a better person from it.
Why was it the worst thing for you? Because the sense of failure you felt?
Oh, yeah. Absolutely that. Yeah. That exactly. I had never imagined that I would be married more than once, ever. And so when that happened, when I found myself in that situation, loser doesn't even express it.
Yeah.
You know, it was dark, dude. I felt like I had blown life. You know, I am in the game of life and I blew life. You know, now, of course, that wasn't true.
No, not at all.
But that's how I felt at the time.
Well, plus, because you were probably carrying around all that shit because you said your mom was divorced, and that didn't sound like it went well, and you probably said, oh, I would never.
No.
That's what you probably had all that shit carrying on in your head.
You put your finger right on it.
Yeah. So I totally get that, man. I understand it. Because when I got divorced, it was like fucking so free. I felt like, man, I'm so free. I'm like that. I was like, this is the worst situation I could have been in. I could really start like growing and living my life now.
Right.
And I never, and it wasn't like I had no intentions of, you know, getting divorced, and I didn't want that to happen, but it so happened that that's what it was. And, you know,
and your takeaway from that then was feeling unshackled and ready to embrace life and living. Yeah.
It was one of the few things I did for myself as a young man. I didn't really make a lot of decisions. Like, I didn't really, positive decisions for me. I had kids at a young age. I didn't really have a good childhood, so I was always like trying to hustle and get out of situations. And so it was one of the first times that I said, man, I need to do this because I need to have a good life, and this is not going to happen in this particular situation. And, you know, thank God everything, you know, worked out. I wound up, I'm with my wife now 25 years. We have a very unique good thing going. I mean, it's not sunshine and roses every day, I'm not gonna lie, but no one is. And but most days it is, you know, and I'm really grateful for that.
Well, that I'm happy to hear you say that, because to me you have done almost you've achieved something if not impossible, improbable, and that's happiness. Just achieving happiness and finding your place in the world is almost everything. At least that's what I think.
Well, thanks for saying that. I'm certainly not finished, and I always feel like I'm a work in progress, but I'm really grateful for where I'm at right now with things. And I, you know, we've worked hard for it, and especially my relationship. People sometimes say, how did you do that? Honestly, beats the shit out of me. I mean, we just worked hard at it, but
yeah,
I think a lot of it's luck, you know, because, you know, you change a lot to find someone that can deal with your bullshit and how you change, and that it's compatible with the way they're changing. I think
that's very hard.
Yeah, I think the odds are slim of that, man, you know. So
that's what I'm saying. It's very hard, very difficult.
I think I'm lucky. You know, I always, this is a weird thing to say, and it may sound like flaky, but I always looked at my wife. Like I said, I had a really, really difficult upbringing, and I always look at that the universe came to me and said, "All right, look, man, we're gonna give you this situation, and we're gonna bring this woman into your life, and level the playing field." And I've always looked at it like that, and so I've been grateful for that, because I felt like I got. Not a lot of people get that. You know, sometimes you just have a shitty start and a shitty finish.
That's right. You're right.
You know, and I said, okay, well, I'm gonna, you know, thank you. And I will honor that, you know, and I was just lucky how it worked.
That is exactly the right attitude.
Yeah.
Thank you. I will honor that. And let's continue to live.
Yeah, right. Let's see. Let's go on the journey now. Finish it up.
Go on the journey. Exactly.
Yeah. So I've just been lucky. I apologize. This is about you, not me. So I talk less.
It's all good, sorry, man. We're just talking.
So this is a relevant question. What is something that you've learned about you along this entire journey?
Wow. That would be hard to express in one thing. I've learned a lot about myself during my own music journey. I guess now from at least in this very moment that you're asking me, I think the thing I've learned about myself is that I'm not a quitter. I mean, I think I always knew it, but now from this vantage point, I'm sure of it. But whatever there is about me, I'm not a rollover guy. And I guess that's something, you know?
Yeah.
That's
a lot.
It's not nothing anyway.
Yeah, it's not nothing. It is something, man, because it's easy to quit. Life is tough. Life's not for the weak.
No.
Is that what you like most about yourself, would you say?
What do I like most about myself? Oh, I don't know. Let me just pat my back for a second. And,
yeah, man, do
you
it.
You know, figure that's it good. Out. No, not at all. I mean, dude, my problem, like many artists, painters, musicians, whatever, is that we often don't like what we see.
Yeah.
That's the struggle that keeps you creating.
Mm.
I look at it this way. If I was completely well-adjusted and a self-loving man, what reason would there be for me to make art?
You got to be dysfunctional to keep it going.
Well, I am trying to walk a tightrope, right? I'm trying to be the artist I want to be while being the man and human I want to be.
Yeah.
And those two things are sometimes in conflict and sometimes not.
Yeah. Well, I think everybody's a little dysfunctional. As long as you manage it, it's within like the normal range of dysfunction. And when it's not, that's when you get problems, I think.
I guess so, yeah.
You know? What's your best childhood memory, John?
I wanted to be from when I was 4 years old. I wanted to be a cowboy.
Wow.
Yeah, I would watch it. Living in Alaska, I would watch singing cowboys. You know, Gene Autry and the rest. And I saw, you know, look, the hat, the horse, the gun, the guitar, and the girl. So I wanted to be a cowboy, and in some ways I got to be one. I got to check this out. I got a chance to live out my cowboy fantasy by being in the first episode of Deadwood for HBO.
Really?
I had a cameo in it and got all gussied up as the town knife sharpener.
That is so cool. So,
yeah, I didn't have any lines, but if you watch the first episode, as the two protagonists are coming into Deadwood, and you look, please don't blink. If you don't blink, you'll see me on the side of on the side of the road.
How did you get that? How did that happen?
Right place, right time. I was living in California, and I fell into a cowboy reenactment group. That's a long story. That led to the opportunity to have a cameo, and so I took it,
Yeah. That's actually really cool that you would join a cowboy reenactment group, to be honest with you, because I haven't done enough shit like that. I think that's very cool. You have an interest, do it.
I was living in California at the time, and I got to be friends with these guys, and just literally one thing led to another, and they asked me if I wanted to come along one morning, like 6 a.m., to this cowboy town where they shot commercials. And so I got dressed up in cowboy boots and a funky hat, and I was in a Budweiser commercial as a cowboy.
Dude, I think that's cool shit.
That was a laugh riot, so I did it some more.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, you know what I want to do? Let's talk about gear just for a few minutes.
Sure.
You've always, at least me, I've always seen you always playing Strats. Did you ever not play Strats, or?
I have a bunch of guitars of every description, but from a live performance standpoint, particularly playing blues and rock,
the Stratocaster worked for me because of its shape, the sound of the guitar, and the fact that it just sort of fit my style.
Hmm.
So it's not that I don't play other guitars or have other guitars. I have a lot of guitars. It's just that the Stratocaster has been, I guess I've had the most public relationship with it.
Sure. What's your go-to guitar right now, and what two other guitars might round out your top three?
I've got a 63 Olympic White Strat. Wow. That I have nicknamed the Fat Man. I play that guitar almost exclusively when it comes to electric guitars. But having said that, when I go to record, I bring a lot of stuff in, a lot of my other guitars with me. I have a 53 Fender Telecaster. So that's definitely one of my top three. And I do a fair number of acoustic shows a year. And so I have a vintage Gibson J45.
Oh, wow.
That I use a lot on the acoustic shows that I do. So I circulate them. I'm pretty much a Fender, a traditionalist, so it's usually Fender or Gibson.
That Olympic White Strat, the one with the rosewood neck that you play?
Yeah.
Are you the original owner of that?
No. That guitar was made in 1963, and I found it in Los Angeles, in L.A. When I first moved to L.A., I guess that would have been 86. I went to Ventura Boulevard or some shop and saw the guitar and grabbed it, and it's been mine ever since.
That's cool, man. Do you have any interesting stories behind how you acquired any of your guitar? Unusual stories?
I don't know. I mean, I have I've received guitars in every possible way. In fact, when I was in high school, a friend of mine, Gaylord Pryor, gave me a 65 Les Paul.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. And at the time, I thought, oh, this is great. And now when I look back on it, I thought, that's impossible, for someone to gift it to me like that. So
yeah.
I'll never forget that. I'll never forget his name. Obviously, I haven't. And I'll never forget that guitar. More's the pity that I don't have it anymore.
I was just going to ask you, what happened to it?
I wish I did. Yeah, I stupidly sold it during my, struggles to be a self-supporting musician.
Yeah, well, you got to do what you got to do, man.
Exactly.
You're not the first guy, definitely not the last guy.
No, yeah, I know.
Who's influenced your playing that people might be surprised to hear?
Richie Havens.
Oh, man.
Jeff Beck. I think that Jeff Beck is literally the greatest living guitar player, period, full stop.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in terms of acoustic guitar, I have been a fan of Richie Havens, since his appearance at Woodstock. I just never got over him.
Mm.
And so he's a huge influence on the way I see acoustic blues, acoustic guitar generally, and a way of making music as a solo artist.
Yeah, he's a great player, man. Just did stuff really innovatively, very unique, and very comfortable. Always seemed super comfortable doing his thing.
I'm also a big fan of Taj Mahal's.
Oh, cool.
I very much like the acoustic blues thing. And so, when I think of music like that, I think of Taj. I think of Richie Havens, and those are two influences on my own style that people may not be aware of.
If I asked you to pick like your Desert Island Discs, the top three in no particular order, and knowing that this can change tomorrow, what are the first three CDs that come to mind? I kind of stopped calling them CDs because that doesn't even exist anymore.
I know.
What are the first three albums?
That's easy. That's easy. Electric Ladyland by Jimi Hendrix.
Yep.
The White Album by the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And probably Houses of the Holy by Led Zeppelin.
Oh, good album. Man.
And from and that's rock. Now there's in terms of like my blues choices or acoustic guitar choices, I don't even know where to start. Because that music is where I really live. And to pick three, I guess I'd have to start with something by Albert King, and then B.B. King. And after that, it gets really difficult.
Albert was your favorite of the Kings?
Oh, yeah. No question about it. Albert Collins, too. Yeah. Both of those guys really turned my head around. Buddy Guy, I know people mention Buddy, and I love Buddy. I love modern day. I love today's Buddy Guy more than I dug him as a young kid.
Hmm.
But Albert King, you know, reduced me to mush.
Well, he was so powerful, a big giant guy. I mean, he just did stuff.
Yeah,
he was really. I feel that
big
way about
giant.
Yeah,
big giant guy with a big giant voice.
Yeah, and he played a big ass guitar. You know those flying V's.
I know
it's not like a little tiny thing, man. And
I know.
He handled it like it was nothing.
He manhandled it. Yeah, exactly.
This might be a question that you can't answer, but if you didn't become a professional musician, what do you think you would have done instead?
Those questions are really tough to answer because you have to sort of go back so far. Dude, I've been a guitar player since I was five,
yeah.
Literally 5 years old. So the only other thing I wanted to be besides that is a cowboy.
Well, that's a good answer. We'll chalk it up to that, cowboy. That's a very good answer.
There's not a lot of money in cowboying these days, but
hey, tell me something about yourself, John, that people would either be surprised to hear or might find a little odd.
I'm not socially outgoing. Meaning, on a Friday night, Friday or Saturday night, if I'm not playing, I like to. I'm a homebody.
Hmm.
I like to be in my pajamas by 10.
Yeah.
And me and Elle will watch a movie and curl up with a cup of tea. And there just isn't a lot of rock starring around here.
I hear you. Did you have a lot of years of rock starring?
Yeah, I think I did.
Yeah.
I think I got it out of my system in the 90s.
Good to be honest. Good for you, man.
You know. By the end of the 90s, I had turned the corner on how I saw myself moving forward. And I knew then that I didn't want to be the guy that was, you know, playing roadhouses at 80.
Yeah.
That I wanted to do other things with my life that were musical, but didn't require me to live a life of a 20-year-old.
Yeah, I get it. And I think that the licensing and sync thing you did is really smart because that's the only way you can get residual, you know, royalties moving forward.
I call it mailbox money.
Right.
I'm so lucky that I felt this way so many years ago because that provides I'll be honest, those residuals from the shows and the TV shows and video games, all that stuff. That's a big part of my, that's a part of my.
Yeah. Good.
And I set those parameters early enough so that now it's a good thing.
Well, yeah, I think that was real smart and I'm glad it worked out for you because I know how hard you've mm-hmm. worked. Do you have any non-musical superpowers, John?
No. And I sure could use some.
Well, I hope you get them.
Me too. I could use any superpowers I could stumble across.
Any hobbies outside of music?
Oh yeah. I guess this is still connected to music, but I got interested in video and filmmaking. So I produce and make all the videos that we do. I usually supervise. I've learned how to video edit, and as a part of my, there is a social media beast that must be fed, and I, for one, couldn't afford to have a film company on call.
Yeah,
and so I had to teach myself. How to create images, be video or film. And so that's become a hobby, and I enjoy it a lot.
That's great. That's not easy stuff at all. It's pretty involved.
No, I had to. It was a learning curve. But again, it was like I can't afford to not do this. I can't afford to not have this knowledge. I felt the same way when I learned Pro Tools for, you know, for recording.
Yeah.
I can't afford not to know this.
Yeah. The pain of not doing it is greater than the short-term pain of having to go through it.
Exactly right. I have been around many a tech learning curve.
Yeah, I hear you. Two more questions, man.
Sure, man.
Person who's had the biggest influence on your life?
My mother.
That's great.
I give her, I know it's a terribly hackneyed answer.
No, it's wonderful.
But I had a relationship with her like a friend.
That's great.
And so I would often seek her counsel. And I feel like the good parts of me, I give her the credit for, to instill in me a sense of purpose and a sense of not being defeated and to try and leave the world better than how you found it.
That's nice, man. I'm afraid to ask who gives credit for the bad parts.
Well, there's a lot of credit to go around for that. Let's just say it that way.
I like that answer. That's great, man. And last question, man. What do you think is the biggest, what's been the biggest change in your personality over, say, the last 10 years? And how much of this change has been deliberate on your part and how much is just a natural part of aging?
Trying to understand others' points of view. I don't know how you how a person can navigate the world sooner or later without trying to figure out how the other person is feeling or processing you. And that sounds simple, but it's really one of the most complicated things to try and get out of your own skull and try and empathize with how someone else is processing a thing to try and find peace. I mean, look, my whole journey at this point is to find happiness, and if not, I don't mean giddiness when I say happiness.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean just a sense of purpose and feeling fulfilled, right?
Yes.
So to do that, it has been incumbent upon me to understand, to better understand my engagements with others, starting with my wife, Lorinda. And extending to my my family, you know, my musical family, my friends. And if I can do that, I think it makes me a better partner. I also think it makes me a better friend. And I'm convinced that it creates more peace inside me.
Less stress, that's for sure.
Yeah, there's enough of that to go around.
Yeah. I hear you, man. That's really cool, man. Listen, I can't thank you enough for your time and candor. I really enjoyed this. I want to tell people, with your help, maybe where they could find you. Let's talk about, first of all, your show coming up on Friday, April 20th. Let's let them know about that again.
Yeah. For anybody listening who's in New England and the Boston area, I'm playing a beautiful venue on the ocean called the Shaolin Lu Performance Center. That's Friday, April 20th. It's called the Spring Guitar Summit, and that promises to be an unforgettable night with a lot of musical guests and a lot of stuff. I'll be playing music from all over my career and movies and all sorts of stuff. I'm really looking forward to that. And as far as my new record, Two Roads East, that can be found at iTunes and downloadable. If you go to my website, you can order a hard copy by getting in touch with us. Two Roads East is 10 new tracks. I hadn't done a new record of new music in years, and I finished this at the end of 2017, and I'm really proud of it. And I would encourage anyone who is interested in what I do and music that I make to check out Two Roads East, easily downloadable at iTunes.
And John's name is spelled J-O-N, so you could go to his website at John Butcher,
yes.
JONBUTCHER.com. And I listened to some of the stuff that he's put out recently, and I listened to that single you did with Tom Guerra.
Yeah.
And, man, your playing on there was just as fiery as it was back in the day, man. So it was great.
I love hearing that.
No,
thank
it was great.
You,
it sounded wonderful. It really did.
Thank you.
It was really good. And I'm assuming you're on all the normal social media channels?
Oh, sure. I can be found at Facebook, and I can be Twittered, and I can be Instagrammed, and all that good stuff.
All righty, man. Hey, man, I can't thank you enough. Any final words of wisdom or final parting words?
I have no words. I have no wisdom, I'm sorry to say, but I will say this. Spring is coming. Thank goodness for spring. I'm looking forward to seeing all my fans out at the various shows that we're doing spring and summer. And all I want to do is thank you, sir, for having me on and giving me this opportunity to go on and on.
Man, it's my pleasure. You kidding? And let me just tell people, so April 20th at the Shaolin Lu Performance Center in Rockport, May 19th, Chance Concert Club in Woonsocket. That's like, mm-hmm. I love that name, Woonsocket. That's in Rhode Island.
yeah.
Gene's Playhouse, Sunday, May 27th, Lincoln, New Hampshire. And the 29th, the Center for the Arts in Natick. Where is that?
Massachusetts.
Natick, Massachusetts.
It's a suburb of Boston and one of the nicest venues in the area. That's a wonderful place.
Awesome. And then the 30th of June. So John's going to be out around the spring and early summer. Check him out. And he's got a show up on his an acoustic show, which is really good, in Rockport, Mass. September, man. So that's cool.
It's actually acoustic. That show is a mix of acoustic and electric. I'm bringing my Gibson J45 for the first part of the show. And the Fat Man, the 63 Olympic white Strat, will close the show with Fire and Fury.
As it should be.
All right, thanks, man. Very much, Craig. I appreciate it, man.
Thank you. I appreciate your time, John. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed this interview as much as I did. Thanks so much to John Butcher for spending time with us on the show and for being so open and candid and for sharing some really cool and interesting stories. And go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get notified of future episodes along with early product announcements and discounts. And remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have some fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody, and I'm out. We hope you enjoyed this show. If you did, subscribe to the Everyone Loves Guitar podcast, and you can do this online at everyonelovesguitar.com or on iTunes. And if you like the show, please leave us a 5-star positive review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the higher our show ranks, and higher rankings mean we get to continue speaking with cool, interesting guests on our show. We'll see you on the next episode, and until then, keep playing your guitar and have fun making music.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.